Welcome back to the Hemingway List. I nearly forgot the name of this podcast. It's the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Anna Karenina. Karenina? God, you think I know how to say it by now. Anna Karenina, Part 1, Chapter 7. Levin's half-brother is having a philosophical debate. Can you exist outside your senses? What do you think? Why has Levin gone to his half-brother's place? And general discussion. Sluggy with 3 G's said, this was a pretty short chapter but touched on one of the raging topics of the time, materialism. In this chapter shouldn't be understood by how we think of the word. Rather, this was a schism in the burgeoning scientific community in regards to humanity's role and relationship to nature. Traditional thinking had been to put humans outside of nature's domain. Humans were special and created in the image of God and not merely a product of the natural forces and laws of nature. The scientific materialism generally argued the opposite. Humans were part of nature and subject to the same natural laws as everything else. Deism was a popular stance against materialists. They were not atheists, but believed more that God set up the world and defined the laws of nature and then let it work as intended. Traditionalists could not abide this idea of an absent God, and the rift only grew wider. Anna Karenina takes place in the early 1870s, and Darwin's Origin of Species had been published not too long before, in 1859. So this was very much a topic that the educated class were discussing at the time. Tolstoy did not think too much of Darwin's ideas, and you can see him push back against the idea of scientific materialism in many ways. Tolstoy also pokes some more fun at the polite conventions of society here again. Levin's brother and the professor are having this debate, but only referencing the arguments of others. In a way, they're not really arguing about the substantive issue, but about what other natural philosophers have said about it. For Levin to break in with an original idea upsets this natural order, and you can see the professor immediately have a strong reaction to this breaking of society's conventions. Dr. Nature 96 said, thanks for the context, really useful information. It was funny when they couldn't answer Levin and passed the question by saying there's not enough info yet. But I thought Levin might have felt put in his place when they did that, not knowing that he had an original idea, which is sad for him. I thought it was an interesting little convo, and to know that context, because I thought, well, is Darwin a thing yet when I was reading this? I didn't know the timeline of it all, but yeah, so about 10 years previous. I also didn't know what year Anna Karenina took place in, the early 1870s. So, good context. We should have probably figured that out earlier, but now we know. So that's a good, 50, 60 years later than War and Peace. It doesn't seem that much of a different time so far, but that's a long time. 60 years. Today's episode, by the way, is brought to you by wine, which I'm drinking. I've just had a writer's group, and during the writer's group, I thought, you know what? I feel like a glass of wine. And so I've still got a little bit of it left, which I better drink. Just sipping. I'm not a big drinker, so half a glass of wine will more than see me through the rest of this episode. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, to me, this chapter serves as more character development of Levin. He is obviously not a country bumpkin, as his outer appearance and occupation might seem to suggest. Euler is a Pimp said, in Tolstoy's last letter, he says, the views you have acquired about Darwinism, evolution, and the struggle for existence won't explain to you the meaning of your life and won't give you guidance in your actions. And a life without an explanation of its meaning and importance and without the unfailing guidance that stems from it is a painful existence. Think about it. I say it probably on the eve of my death because I love you. There's some truth to that. We spoke about this earlier on, well, not during Anna Karenina, but in previous books. About, a lot of these old Russian books, actually, they talk about this kind of changing over from religion to science, I suppose you could put it that way. Or like human truths versus scientific truths, maybe is a better way to think of it. Not necessarily religion, but things that are sort of more symbolic to human existence. They're true through humanness, because that's what we are, right? So there's things that aren't scientifically quantifiable, but seem true if you're a human. And we are humans, so to us, they are true. And if you act as if those things are true, then you can function as a human, because they're useful little rules or truths, maybe. And then you can also start to look at truth through the scientific lens, and anything you discover through that lens to be true, well, that's also a kind of truth. But there are, if you're a human, two types of truth in that sense then. There's human truth and there's scientific truth. Both of those can be contradictory or don't necessarily follow the same logic. But so long as you are a human, which we are, then both of those types of truth will hold true. Am I making sense? Probably not. But that's, I think, what he's getting at there about, like, Darwinism and evolution won't explain the struggle for existence. It won't explain the meaning of your life. True in a way. True in a way. Yulia Ozapim says, as to the content of evolution itself, though, Tolstoy was a believer in a radical pacifist Christian philosophy. His unfair reading of Darwin places struggle for existence and dominance at the center of human affairs. If materialism is true, which would clash with his values of the meek inheriting the earth and seeking ascension through non-violence. At the end of the day, Tolstoy was a Christian. A lot of his writing picks apart the question of changing from a religious mindset to a scientific one, and doesn't always seem to take a side too strongly. So he's got characters on either side of that fence, and he does a good job of keeping them fairly balanced. But at the end of the day, he was a Christian, and that was his take on it, at least. But his books don't come across as too preachy or anything like that. He's more exploring the ideas from a pretty balanced point of view. I Am Norwegian said, haha, it didn't take long until we were faced with materialists again. It seems Tolstoy was just as alert to what was going on as Dostoevsky. It's the death of God. Levin picks up on this, asking if their theories do not preclude the possibility of humans having a soul. The professor and Levin's brother are discussing matters of epistemology, of the nature of truth, and our ability to discover it. It's phenomenology, empiricism, logic, and reason. Then Levin dares to butt in with a metaphysical question. The same thing happened at the end of The Brothers Karamazov in the court scene. And similarly, the metaphysics was met with more of a scoff than anything else. Tekrivik said, and the body-mind problem is still unresolved. As an answer to Anders' first discussion prompt, we still don't know is the long and short of it. Using the scientific method to potentially uncover if there's anything beyond materialism is still doable, so the clash of ideas is a little misconstructed, in my honest opinion, but perhaps there is a need for this to be a case of non-overlapping magisteria, as Stephen J. Gould would put it. Some questions are scientific questions, and other questions, such as the dilemma, for example, is a moral question. It's important not to engage in pretense when talking about science and religion, and I think we did a pretty good job when we read The Brothers Karamazov, not to muddy the waters and also being respectful at the same time. I think so too, and I think Tolstoy and Dostoevsky do a decent job of representing the argument rather than representing a side of the argument. And I suppose in society, people were engaging in that conversation, especially, you know, Darwinism had just been created. So the hot topic, right, among the intellectuals would be that conversation. And so they didn't really want to necessarily represent a side of that conversation. They just wanted to have the characters engaging in that conversation. Little Birdie said, Levin's conflict with existence is portrayed as he takes part in a philosophical debate. They consider psychological and physiological factors, which Levin tries to understand. Come on, Little Birdie, you can't put philosophical, psychological, and physiological all in one sentence and expect me to say that sentence correctly after a glass of wine. Unacceptable. He had never himself connected these scientific deductions about man's origin as an animal, about reflexes, biology, and sociology, with the questions concerning the meaning of life and death that had recently come more and more frequently into his mind. Levin, like other intellectuals, is trying to find a connection between the scientific and the spiritual, but can't. Even as the others discussed, they seem to beat a hasty retreat from what he considers the core of the issue. Can we understand life and death through science? It worries Levin. The one thing he wants to know from the discussion is, if my body dies, no further existence is possible. It's a frightening question. What happens to us after we die? Levin is only 32 years old, but has begun to grapple with this idea, and no one is able to give him an answer. But why is the life-death question so hard to understand? I think it's because a scientific philosophical approach can't help you understand why you're alive. When Koznishev, and the professor try to apply their more than expansive knowledge of the natural sciences to the question, it is in vain. They end up over-dissecting, over-categorizing a topic that is so abstract into a sphere of subtle distinctions, reservations, quotations, and allusions. Levin, trying to understand and follow such an argument, only feels more at a loss. It's sad. Koznishev and the professor are so knowledgeable, yet they can't answer Levin's rather simply put question. Who can, though? They know so much, but can't understand what they're living for and why. Tolstoy would call this intellectual sterility. You can't approach existence from an intellectual standpoint. It's life. It doesn't take a mental consciousness of existence or the totality of your physical sensations, but an emotional, spiritual, morally sensitive experience of the world. Maybe you've just got to take life and all its experiences, feel all the emotions it throws at you, and live in the way that is most meaningful to you, and then the death part of the life-death question falls out of significance. I think Tolstoy is trying to say that an intellectual conversation about books and research can't unlock what it means for a person to live and die. Levin doesn't seem to know this yet, but he certainly is sensitive to the fact that their conversation isn't leading anywhere meaningful, and it frustrates him. The life-death question is one that's important to him, as it was to Tolstoy and probably every human being. Mar Foster 87 said, outside the senses the body can exist, there is function thanks to involuntary muscles. However, there is no existence beyond that. Without a mind-body connection, without the senses, one cannot participate in the fundamental experiences of existence. If that is the case, if the individual is not consciously participating, how then can we believe there to be existence beyond the senses? Think of someone who develops locked-in syndrome later in life. I'm specifically referring to the diving bell and the butterfly. I have not read this personally, but my wife has. Thus, I am familiar with the story/syndrome. Additionally, an active man wakes up and is completely paralyzed, save the ability to blink his eyes. There is a mind-body disconnect. Is this lifestyle existence? At what point do we draw the line? But pull back a little. I believe these same questions are raised when thinking about Levin's character. What I've drawn from him is that he is insecure, self-deprecating, and afraid to take chances. I believe we are introduced to him at a time in his life where he is considering his mark in the world. He isn't familiar with taking chances, until now, when his intentions are to propose to Kitty. Yet he is depending on the opinions of others to take that leap, which leads me to believe he isn't going to take the chance, or he isn't going to take it soon enough. He has the ability to participate in existence, but it seems he is wavering in the process of choosing to take the helm and steer the ship into a direction he desires. Keeping it well said, there's more to the brain than just the sensory cortex. I'm honestly not sure why Levin went to his half-brother's place, maybe to ask for proposal advice. Perhaps I missed something. Levin and company are definitely underestimating Levin. Levin and company are definitely underestimating Levin. Cool. All right. The old philosophical debate. Tolstoy doesn't do a lot of philosophical debate. At least War and Peace he didn't. Not really. But that chapter very much was just like dead on, like, this is the topic. Right? This is the topic. Here is the philosophical debate. And go. But, cool. I don't know. I suppose it was all the rage at that time. Can you imagine Darwinism not existing and then existing? And just being like, what? Like, that whole new perspective on what we are as a creature. Pretty mind-blowing, right? I mean, maybe it wasn't that new. Maybe there was already theories and stuff like that. And Darwin just confirmed them. But, yeah, still, pretty major thing. Surely one of the biggest turning points in human existence. So, you know, that's no small thing. This wine's delicious. I'm a little bit tipsy. I do not drink much at all. I don't know why I decided to have wine tonight, but hey, when in Rome. Project Tolstoy, by the way, is buzzing along. I am, let's just put it this way. Draft one was finished a few days ago. That's when I announced it to you guys. And I was very excited that the first draft was finished. I am now 15/28 of the way through proofreading. 15/28. So, you know, roughly halfway. Could put it that way, but 15/28 is more fun to say. And that's only taken me about 2-ish days to get that far. So I reckon in a week, I will launch Project Tolstoy. That's not the name of the project. That's the code name because I don't want to tell you guys what it is yet. But I'm really excited to share this with you guys. I think you're going to like it. You might hate it. That's also very, very possible. Sorry, I'm going to plug that every single day until it's a thing. Because I don't know how else to do hyping. I'm not a very good salesperson. All right. On that very bad note, let us continue reading this book. Anna Karenina, Part 1, Chapter 8, goes exactly like this. When the professor had gone, Koznishev turned to his stepbrother. I'm very glad you have come. Are you here for long? How do you get on with your farming? Levin knew that farming did not interest his older brother, and that the question was merely a concession. Therefore, he replied generally as to the sale of wheat and money matters. He wanted to tell his brother of his intended marriage and to ask his advice. Hey, who guessed that? Was it you keeping it well? Keeping it well. I'm honestly not sure why Levin went to his half-brothers, maybe to ask for proposal advice. Nailed it. Where was I up to? He wanted to tell his brother of his intended marriage and to ask his advice. He had even firmly made up his mind to do so. But when he saw his brother and heard his conversation with the professor, and afterward noticed the involuntary patronizing tone in which he asked him about the business of their estate which they had jointly inherited from their mother, had not been divided, and Levin was managing the whole of it, he felt that something prevented him from beginning to speak to his brother about his intention to marry. He felt that his brother would not look at the matter as he wished him to. "Well, and how is your zemstvo getting on?" asked Koznishev, who took a keen interest in the rural administration and attached great importance to it. "I really don't know." "What? But you are a member." "No, I am no longer on it. I resigned," answered Levin, "and don't attend the meetings any more." "That's a pity," said Koznishev, and frowned. To justify himself, Levin began to relate what used to happen at the meetings in his district. "There now, it's all the same," interrupted Koznishev. "We Russians are always like that. It may be a good trait in us, this capacity to see our own faults, but we overdo it, and comfort ourselves with sarcasm, which is always ready on our tongues. I can only tell you that with such rights as we have in our rural institutions, any other European nation, the English or the Germans, would have secured their freedom, while we only jeer at our vemstvovs. But what is to be done? Said Levin guiltily. That was my last attempt, and I tried with my whole soul, but I can't do it. I'm incapable. Incapable, said Koznishev. No, you don't look at it from the right point of view. That may be, said Levin mournfully. Do you know that our brother Nicholas is here? Nicholas was Konstantin Levin's elder brother and Koznishev's half-brother. He was a ruined man who had squandered the greater part of his fortune, mixed with the strangest and worst society, and quarrelled with his brothers. You don't mean to say so, cried Levin, horror-struck. How do you know? Prokofy met him in the street. Here in Moscow, where is he, do you know? Levin rose from his chair as if meaning to go at once. I'm sorry I told you, said Koznishev, shaking his head at his brother's excitement. I sent to find out where he is living and forwarded him a note of hand he had given to Trubin, which I had paid. And this is the answer I received. Koznishev took a note from under a paperweight and handed it to his brother. Levin read the note, written in a curious but familiar hand. I humbly beg you to leave me alone. That is all I demand of my dear brothers. Nicholas Levin. When Levin had read the note, holding it in his hand, he remained standing in front of Koznishev, without lifting his head. A struggle was going on within him between the desire to forget his unfortunate brother for the present and the consciousness that this would be wrong. He evidently wants to offend me, continued Koznishev, but he cannot do that. I wish with all my heart I could help him, but I know it can't be done. Yes, yes, said Levin, I understand and appreciate your attitude toward him, but I personally shall go to see him. Go if you like, but I don't advise it, said Koznishev. That's to say, I'm not afraid of it on my own account. He will not make mischief between us, but on your account I don't advise it. You had better not go. It's impossible to help him. However, do as you please. It may be impossible to help him, but I feel, especially at this moment, but that's a different matter, I feel that I cannot be at peace. Well, I don't understand that, said Koznishev. But what I do understand is a lesson in humility. I have begun to look differently, more leniently, at what is called rascality, since Brother Nicholas became what he is. Do you know what he has done? Ah, it's dreadful, dreadful, Levin repeated. Having got the address from Koznishev's footman, Levin thought of going at once to see his brother, but on reflection decided to put off the visit until the evening. To obtain peace of mind, it was necessary first of all to decide the business that had brought him to Moscow. He therefore went to Oblonsky's office, and having received news of the Shcherbatskys, he drove to the place where he was told he could see Kitty. All right, there we go. That's another chapter done. Have your say about that chapter over on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.